From VOA, Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. As we commemorate July 4th, which is Independence Day in the United States, we will talk with a prominent member of Congress. He received a degree from Brigham Young University in business management before working as a small business owner. He was then elected as the mayor of Provo, Utah, where he served two terms and, as his website notes, averaged an approval rating of 93%. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman John Curtis, a Republican from the western state of Utah, who is serving his third term in the House of Representatives, the lower chamber of Congress. According to his website, John Curtis serves on the House Committee of Energy and Commerce and is the chair of the Conservative Climate Caucus. Congressman Curtis's website notes that this caucus is centered on the idea that climate change is a real problem that can be solved with innovation and investment in the private sector. The caucus acknowledges that climate change is a global issue that requires the cooperation of all countries, including China. Congressman Curtis, who speaks Mandarin Chinese, was a member of the China Task Force, which in its September 2020 report found the Chinese Communist Party to be the greatest national and economic security challenge of this generation. Utah's 3rd District, which Congressman Curtis represents, encompasses the southeastern portion of the state. We will talk with him about a variety of domestic issues facing the nation, including climate change, the rising threat of China, and infrastructure legislation. Regular listeners may remember that we had the pleasure of interviewing Congressman Curtis several years ago in his office, so we are delighted to welcome him back. Congressman Curtis joins us via Microsoft Teams. Congressman John Curtis, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's been too long. Let's not wait so long next time.
Sounds good to me. Congressman Curtis, under former President Donald Trump, many in the Republican Party either denied or minimized the impacts of climate change. And the Pew Research Center reported just about 1 year ago in a survey that 72% of Democrats believe that human activity contributes a great deal to climate change as opposed to only 22% of Republicans. Congressman, to what do you attribute this discrepancy between the two political parties over the causes and impacts of climate change?
Yeah, I really regret that Republicans have allowed ourselves to be branded as either denying science or not caring about the environment. I actually personally don't believe for most of us that that's actually true. And like so many things, those on the extremes and the ones that are loudest tend to get all the attention. And my experience by talking about climate as a Republican has been very well received. And I'm finding so many of my colleagues that actually agree with me.
Congressman Curtis, before we get into the specifics of your conservative climate caucus, I wanted to get your take on the massive heat wave affecting the Pacific Northwest in the United States, like Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. They're experiencing what we call triple-digit temperatures. That's above 100 degrees Fahrenheit. For our international listeners, that's more than 33 to 40 degrees Celsius. These are unheard of at this time of year. Some analysts are attributing this drastic heat in part to climate change because there's a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that renders naturally occurring heat waves much worse. What's your take on this excessive, unprecedented heat wave?
Carol, I'm not a scientist, and it's hard for me to really understand, you know, the specific science on something like this. And so I think when we see events like this, it's important to realize they might be part of global warming, but what we know for sure is that overall trends are warming. And so a specific instance, it's hard to say, yes, it's part of it or it's not, but it's clear that if you look at trends, and so one of those, for instance, in that same region is a drought. Right now, Utah is experiencing the driest summer that we've had, some will say, on record. And so it's easier for me to see how these trends point to the changes in the climate, and a little bit harder for me to see specific instances of weather to know whether that's part of this picture or if it's just an anomaly.
So what prompted you, Congressman Curtis, from the beautiful state of Utah, to create a separate conservative climate caucus for Republicans only? How does it differ, for example, from the bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus?
Well, first of all, you got me on that beautiful state of Utah. I just want to underscore that. It is an amazing, beautiful state. And quite frankly, probably has a little bit to do, maybe a lot to do with my view of protecting the climate and the environment. Now, to more specifically answer your question, I feel like, as I've kind of watched what's happening, is that couple of things are unfolding, and that is that Republicans have allowed ourselves, by our silence, to be branded as not caring about the environment. And to be frank, I don't think we have spent enough time educating Republican members of Congress, talking about these issues and our solutions. And so therefore, while I think a bipartisan group is extremely important, I also think a partisan group of Republicans, meaning that they're just Republicans, is very, very healthy to a broader dialogue, because we have been missing from the dialogue. We need to start with some real basics about our ideas and our solutions. And so we can bring those forward to the bipartisan group. And instead of coming with just Democratic ideas, which we normally oppose, bring ideas of our own.
That brings me to ask you, Congressman Curtis, about the differences between your sense of how to combat climate change versus that of some Democrats. In relation to your climate caucus, your website says you wanted to, quote, bring Republicans to the table to fight against radical progressive climate proposals that would hurt our economy, American workers, and national security. What proposals are you referring to that you think would harm the U.S. economy, worker, and national security?
Well, you don't have to look very far into the Green New Deal to see we're shutting down airline travel and we're eliminating entire industries. You have to ask why and what would it accomplish? And I think that's one of the things that we want to do as Republicans, is when we bring ideas forward, talk about, are they just feel-good ideas, or do they really move the worldwide greenhouse gas emission needle? That's what I think we need to be talking about. And too often we don't. Too often we talk about things and it may sound good, but does it really change the overall greenhouse gas emission? And so I think you'll see the ideas coming from us, ideas that are substantial, that radically impact worldwide greenhouse gas emissions as far as reducing them. And at the same time, those ideas actually help the U.S. economy instead of hurting it, like we hear from some on the other side of the aisle.
Can you give us some examples of these types of proposals?
Yeah, absolutely. So frequently, things like carbon sequestration and direct air capture are kind of poo-pod is not realistic. But I would counter that with saying, look, if we're going to reduce worldwide greenhouse gas emissions, and you got to remember the United States is only less than 15% of worldwide greenhouse gas emissions, we have to have ideas here that deal with the vast amounts of greenhouse gas emissions coming out of China and India and Russia. And I don't know how you do that if you're not using something like direct air capture and carbon sequestration. So we'd like to see greater investment into that. I'd like to see those ideas mature and see what they can do. I think you're fooling yourselves if we don't bring in nuclear into this conversation. And I'm fine with those who have opposition to certain nuclear problems. I don't think we need to assume that nuclear always has to be what it's been. I think we can aspire to a next generation nuclear and solve some of the concerns that people have with nuclear power. But let's face it, right now, nuclear is 20% of our energy capacity. By the time President Biden wants to be at half of our current output on greenhouse gas emissions, we're going to cut nuclear in half, and we need to be going the opposite direction. And then one that really surprises people that I think we need to think about is this concept of using fossil fuels to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's no secret that we've reduced more greenhouse gas emissions here in the United States than the next 10 carbon-reducing countries combined. How have we done it? We've done it with natural gas. So if China and Russia and India are going to continue to be large coal-burning nations, why not step up and say, let's use U.S. natural gas to lower their greenhouse gas emissions? Those ideas have not really been on the table. They haven't been discussed and debated. And those are just some of the ideas that you'll hear coming from this group.
Well, that's really interesting. I wanted to ask you if you think, despite the differences, are there points of convergence between what you consider, you know, the more radical Democratic proposals to combat climate change and your caucus's proposals? Do you think there could be common ground?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've been really heartened at the number of Democrats that have approached me since we launched this caucus, and they are really excited for what we're doing. That pleases me because it tells me they're more concerned about results than they are about politics. I'm just really pleased a lot of my Democratic colleagues have been cheering us on as they see that we're willing to talk about these issues. And so I think we'll find a lot of bipartisan consensus. And I've always said, you know, the extremes on the left are there, but so are the extremes on the right. And what we really need to be talking, or let's get off of these extremes and let's come together, let's find things that we can agree on, bring our ideas, bring their ideas, let's let them bubble up. And I suspect we're going to find a tremendous amount of bipartisan consensus once Republicans start coming to the table to talk about this.
Congressman Curtis, I heard you mention nuclear energy and natural gas. But would you also support your conservative climate caucus more solar and wind energy sources?
Yeah, and let me just kind of clarify the difference between my own personal views and that of the caucus. The caucus obviously needs to speak as a group, and I don't have the ability to do that. So I will just simply say that personally, yes, of course. We have seen, for instance, that solar can be a low-cost energy solution. And another way that we're going to get China and India and Russia and some of these other countries that put out a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, there are very few ways the U.S. can influence them. But one of the ways we can is by providing a lower-cost alternative. And I think solar, you know, is quickly fitting into that. And so I think it's that industry is maturing. And so absolutely, I think we just need to go with vigor after all of these solutions and be thoughtful about which ones will work, which ones have the most impact, and which ones we can actually implement overseas.
Congressman Curtis, President Biden has elevated climate change to the top of his domestic and foreign policy agenda. He has proposed legislation that promotes clean energy, that would create clean blue-collar jobs in his infrastructure proposals. Are you in favor in principle of this aggressive approach?
That's a really hard question. I don't mind telling you that I have been disappointed with what we've seen coming from President Biden. It's very partisan. Much of it is in the category of kind of what I would say is the extremism. And I represent a county, and it's called Carbon County. These jobs he's talking about, they can't touch and feel and see them. They don't like it when somebody from Washington, D.C. says, I'm going to teach you how to code. They're worried about their futures and their futures of their kids. And without actually getting into that community and understanding what this transition and how brutal this transition is for them, it's really hard for Washington to mandate these solutions. And I think we've done a really terrible job of reaching out to communities that are in transition and showing them that we truly care about them. These are good men and women. In many ways, they bore the brunt of the Industrial Revolution on their backs, both with safety and health and working conditions. And I think we owe them a little bit more than that.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Our special guest is Congressman John Curtis, a Republican from the state of Utah. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Ianacho Ignatius from Owerri in Imo State, Nigeria. Thank you for your nice note, Mr. Ignatius. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Congressman John Curtis, a Republican from the state of Utah. Congressman Curtis, one of the central ideas of the Conservative Climate Caucus is that fossil fuels should not be taken off the table of solutions for climate change, despite the fact that they are a large contributor to it. Can you explain why they should remain a part of U.S. energy choices?
I'm going to repeat myself a little bit, but let's just say, for one thing, they're a tool to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We've done that here in the United States with natural gas. So why would we take something off the table that has actually been our most powerful tool here in the United States of reducing greenhouse gas emissions? And I think we tend to talk about fossil fuels as if they're all in one category, and they're very, very different. And coal is obviously very different than natural gas. And so just to put them into all one category, I think is a mistake. I think it's also a mistake not to consider technologies that, for instance, carbon sequestration, that make them neutral in their carbon footprint, and even direct air capture, which can make them far more than the neutral, very negative. So you have to ask yourself, is our goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or is it to eliminate a specific industry? And if your goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then fossil fuels must be on the table.
Indeed. Of course, there's going to be quite a bit of differences over that. But let me go back to infrastructure. As you know, there is a tentative bipartisan agreement. It has been reported that some elements regarding combating climate change and promoting renewable energy were left out of that package. Nonetheless, and this is sort of a follow-up to the previous question I posed, do you agree that there can be a place for policies that promote reducing CO2 and promoting clean energy jobs in the framework of infrastructure?
This is a difficult question because I need to know the details, right, of how we're actually going to do that. It shouldn't be forgotten or overlooked that right now government is way behind industry on this. Industry is leading out on changes, and the government is, despite wanting to regulate this, the industry is already ahead of us quicker than we can move as a government. We see corporations all the time making commitments to cut their carbon in half or to be carbon neutral. I talked to a railroad today who had set a goal to reduce their carbon emissions by 26% in just a couple of years. And so I think in one sense, the government must be careful not to stop this good work that's happening. And if we're not careful as a government, sometimes we do that. It's also difficult if government's going to mandate the solution to private sector and they don't even know what the solution is. Then, you know, we try to send the industry off in a certain direction. They frequently know better than we do on how to reach these goals. So let's go to some of the ideas that have been out there, which is putting in a vast infrastructure of chargers across the country. Well, what if we don't have the grid to support those? Right. And that's what I mean by getting ahead of the private sector. Like, shouldn't we be talking about putting that grid in? What happens if those electrical vehicles are charged on coal? So all of those are very, very important questions. And that's why it's just super hard to ask this kind of blank question of, can you support this coming from the president? So much has not really been discussed, and we don't know the details to a lot of it.
Well, that's a very good point. Will you and your colleagues, caucus colleagues, seek a dialogue with the bipartisan caucus on climate solutions and perhaps directly with the administration to coordinate policy prescriptions on this very important issue?
I think, Carol, you've hit at the very most important thing, which is that's why we're forming, so that we can be part of that dialogue. We haven't been there in the past. The whole point of this caucus is to interject ourselves into that debate and meet people at the table with goodwill and open minds, willing to talk about some of the questions you and I have discussed today. And we're going to bring our own ideas, too, that have not necessarily been discussed. A couple of them we brought up today. And this is very, very healthy, what we're talking about. Anybody that's interested in the climate should be cheering this. Not that we have it all figured out, but that we want to be at the table, we want a seat at the table, and we want to be part of these discussions.
Turning to the world stage, Congressman Curtis, the United States and China together represent almost 40% of global emissions. And on his first day in office, as you know, President Biden reversed former President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, to which China has signed on. Are you in favor of the United States returning to the Paris Climate Accord?
Well, let's just break it down just a little bit. You say that we're responsible for 40%, but we know the U.S. is responsible for less than 15%. That means that China is responsible for a whopping amount of greenhouse gas emissions, far in excess of what's coming out of the United States. And the Paris Accord not only tells them they don't have to cut back, but allows them to increase their emissions for the next 20 years. So, of course, I've got concerns about that. If here again, let me come back to this concept of what really matters is worldwide greenhouse gas emissions. And the Paris Accord fails in cutting worldwide greenhouse gas emissions because we don't hold China accountable. And as a matter of fact, we let them continue to increase their emissions for the next two decades. Now, it depends on who you listen to, but it'll be too late in two decades when China finally gets around, if they ever get around to cutting their emissions. I think we've got to be more honest about the science in this. And the science tells us that China must engage immediately.
And so you don't think that the Paris Accord does enough to pressure them?
Yeah. I mean, in the accord, it lets them continue to increase their emissions for 20 years. How can anybody think that that's enough?
Is there a difference between how the accord treats China vis-a-vis the United States or India or any of these other large CO2 emitters?
Yeah, so we talk about China a lot, but India must be in the conversation. Russia must be in the conversation. I think one of the reasons that we are a little tougher on China is their kind of refusal to be part of worldwide solutions. I don't know that we're sensing that same thing, for instance, from India. But we've got to be realistic about the economy on the ground in India. We have people cooking with wood, and that's the terrible thing for carbon emissions, right? So let's work with India, particularly, who would be willing to work with us. And this is a really good example where we could use fossil fuels to dramatically lower greenhouse gas emissions coming from India and increase their quality of life in a substantial way by moving them from these wood stoves or coal-burning stoves to natural gas.
I would like to return to China, Congressman Curtis. It's a huge challenge for the United States. They're challenging democracy around the world. What is the best way for the United States to approach its relationship with China, especially when we must work with them to combat climate change, even as they commit human rights abuses, for example, against the Muslim Uyghur population, and their crackdown on Hong Kong democracy activists.
Boy, I'll tell you, Carol, both of those points break my heart, and I've been very close to this. Your listeners may remember I speak Mandarin Chinese. I lived over in the Orient for 3 years and have watched very carefully what's happening with the Uyghurs and with Hong Kong, and it is not good. And I was served on the China Task Force last year here in Congress, and this is an oversimplification, but many people feel like we should sever our relationship with China, that we should decouple our relationship. And if you compare this to a marriage, I'm proposing we don't need a divorce, but we do need marriage counseling. Right? The relationship is not healthy. And it's not a healthy relationship. The trajectory is not a good trajectory. And there's, I think, in my mind, a heavy burden on President Biden's shoulders on this. This may be one of the very most important things he does. And you can view that from a climate perspective. You can view that from a human rights perspective. You can view that from an economic perspective. Right? Almost any lens you put on, this is a serious problem for President Biden, and one for which, you know, he needs all of us to help him move the trajectory to improve this relationship. We don't have the luxury of having a bad relationship with China. We must fix this relationship, but it is very, very broken.
Do you have any specific policy recommendations that you would encourage the Biden administration to take towards China?
You know, I am originally a big critic of President Trump's tariff approach, and I've been pleased, actually, in hindsight now, that President Biden has not changed that very dramatically. That helps us hold an upper hand. One of the things I think that's too often overlooked is that the stronger our relationship is with other countries, the more we're able to change our China relationship. So continuing to strengthen trading ties, like doing things like the new MCA with Mexico and Canada, and getting back into trade agreements with our other allies around the world, all of those things will strengthen our hand as we deal with China. We've got to have partners in this around the world, and a lot of partners that have the type of influence that's needed with China.
I guess you must be heartened somewhat then in the aftermath of President Biden's trip to Europe with the EU partners and NATO. They seem to be more in sync on China as a threat and work perhaps together.
I think that's true. And we haven't talked a little about COVID. There's still a lot we don't know about COVID and its origins. But I think in many ways, COVID has awoken a lot of our partners around the world to say, look, you know, we've got to understand what's happening over there in China. I think a lot of Americans are now understanding some of the things that you've talked about, you know, with the human rights violations and some of the other things that are happening over there, to realize that the relationship's not as healthy as many people thought that it was.
Congressman Curtis, I have a rapid fire several more questions before I let you go on foreign policy. I know you're very interested in foreign affairs. You were on the Foreign Affairs Committee before. How about the Iran deal? In addition to the Paris Climate Agreement, President Biden would like to re-enter this Iran nuclear deal to try to curb and prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. What's your position on that?
Well, the original Iran deal had some serious flaws, and a couple of those flaws were that it sunset and that we were only temporarily holding Iran back from developing nuclear weapons. That can't be a viable option. We've got to deal with them on a long-term and a permanent basis. And so that part has me very concerned. It also didn't deal with ballistic missiles, which have to be part of this agreement. So if President Biden is going to go into this and start from scratch and get a good deal, I'm his cheerleader. If he goes into this and just tries to reinstate the deal we had before, there's these serious flaws that make it very hard for me to support.
How about the announcement about the U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan by September 11th of this year? Are you for or against this move?
I had an opportunity to visit Afghanistan right before COVID. It is a very unstable place. I've never been anywhere in the world where I felt at unease as I did in Afghanistan. So I do have reservations about a total withdrawal. I do applaud a mentality, a thought that says, you know, we need to get out of these engagements, and I'd like to see us do that. But boy, it's so important that we don't lose the good progress that we've made over there.
And turning now to domestic issues, Congressman Curtis, that bipartisan committee to investigate the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol, as you know, was defeated. I would like to get your position on that. Were you for or against that bipartisan commission?
I was actually one of the few Republicans that actually voted for it. I don't know how many of us there were, but not a lot. I have questions I want answered. And I know that there were some worries that it would not be a bipartisan commission, that partisanship would sneak into it. But I felt compelled by the unanswered questions to support that. Who knew what, and how soon did they know it, and Why weren't we better prepared? And why did it take the National Guard so long to get there? These are serious questions that until we really understand the answers, I don't think we'll know fully who to blame January 6th on. And I would like to have seen us had answers on that.
Now that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is putting together a select committee, is that at least an alternative to the bipartisan commission?
It's an alternative, but I think it fails before it even starts because it'll be viewed as partisan. I regret that my colleagues in the Senate actually couldn't come together and find a way to support the House bill and let it go to conference, because anything Nancy does, no fault of her own, it's just going to be painted as partisan. I don't think there's any way around that. And it's going to be hard for people to accept the results if it's partisan.
Congressman Curtis, what about the voting rights legislation? We've seen a slew of Republican-led states around the country enacting restrictive voting laws. What's your position on that? Are you concerned about that trend?
Well, I think it depends on your definition of restrictive. I know, for instance, many states, Delaware is an example that's been used, have more restrictive laws than Georgia. And I think there's a lot of hypocrisy in pointing the finger there. This is the fact. The Constitution gives states the rights to oversee their elections. The federal government should not be meddling in the state's business. Now, what does that mean? That means there are some states that are going to be far more liberal than I would like. It also means there's going to be some states that are going to be more conservative than many people like. That's the beauty of the Constitution, and it's the beauty of states. And it's just wrong for the federal government to intercede into that. And particularly when you're saying, okay, well, one party that dominates gets to make all the rules. Well, it should have surprised anybody that the other party feels like there'll be unfair rules. That's the beauty of the states doing this, and it represents those people. Now, if they step across the lines, that's what the court's for. We know that the attorney general is going to sue Georgia. Let's see how that plays out in the courts. But short of that, it's the state's prerogative to do what they want, whether or not I like it or not.
I do take your point, Congressman Curtis, but some critics would say that the fact that many of these states have enacted stricter voting laws that do seem to disproportionately affect African Americans and other minorities, they're saying that they were premised on the so-called big lie that there was somehow fraud in the 2020 election. Of course, former President Trump perpetuated that lie. And I think that's probably the crux of the problem.
I agree with you. It has been very unhealthy the way the election results have been questioned. I was one of the first Republicans to actually congratulate President Biden. Let me be clear about that. But there is a lot of doubt in people's minds about the viability of our election system. And we should applaud states who are trying to make their elections more credible.
And as we close, Congressman Curtis, at the beginning, we talked about the fact that Republicans are more likely to be skeptical of climate change and ways of combating climate change and even the fact that it exists or not. And of course, we talked about former President Trump and his very disproportionate influence on the party. How do you see that? You're a Republican. Are you concerned about the future of the party? Do you see former President Trump as a standard bearer, or are you part of a different wing or section of the party?
Well, boy, we need an hour for that question, Carol, but let me try to be succinct. Let me just point out that a third of the Republican conference joined our conservative climate caucus. And the very first tenet of that caucus is that the climate's changing and Matt's had some influence over that. That should speak volumes right there to answer your question. I also think if you go back not too many years ago, the Democrats were facing the same fracture within their party. There were a number of progressives that came into the caucus and they were threatening to split the caucus, and they united in a pretty significant way to elect President Biden. And I actually have confidence in the Republican conference as well, that we will unite. Sure, we have our differences, just as the Democrats do. And I think that's, quite frankly, one of our biggest challenges, Republicans, is to understand that the enemy without is greater than the enemy within. And if we don't take back the House in a year and a half, I think it'll be nobody to blame but ourselves, because it will be because of infighting.
Congressman John Curtis is a Republican from the state of Utah. He is founder of the Conservative Climate Caucus. Congressman Curtis, thank you so much for your valuable time and insights. It was a delight to speak with you.
Likewise, Carol. Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.